This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Trainer Todd Pletcher has reached the stratosphere.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Moon over Miami for Bill Mott.
3,000 for trainer Mark Cassie.
Trainer D-Way Lucas, a 6th win.
And Bob Baffert with another incredible milestone.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Win number 1,000 for the great Trevor McCarthy.
Here's 2,000 for Nick Zito.
Steve Asmussen is now North America's all-time leading trainer.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to be back in the starting gate with you for the next hour. This, of course, is the show trainers listen to, and you are listening all across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or streaming us live or podcast on our website at horseracingradio.net. You know, I love when I have the opportunity to welcome people to this show, like Todd Pletcher and Steve Asmussen and Chad Brown, Richard Mandela, Bill Mott, just to name a few. They've all been on this program over the years. But as so many of you know who have listened to these trainer talk shows for nearly a decade now, and you know it very well, I also love when I'm able to visit with trainers who are just launching their careers. It's your chance to get to know the future stars of our sport, if you will. And it is certainly understandable if you have never heard of my guest on today's show. The 39-year-old, almost made him 29, the 39-year-old grew up in the Derby City of Louisville, Kentucky. He has yet to saddle a horse on his own, at least here in the United States, but with his extensive background and the experience that he has accumulated over the years, you have to think he'll be finding himself in the headlines before too long. Please join me in welcoming trainer Whit Beckman to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Whit, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I should say good afternoon. See, I'm all messed up today. I'm making you 29. I'm saying good morning instead of good afternoon. Happy to have you with me today, though, buddy.
No, I appreciate it. Just being mentioned in the same lineup as all those trainers is pretty good.
All of those trainers have one thing in common. They have all worked their tail off to get to where they are today. And I know that you, just starting out at Churchill Downs with, I guess, about 6 horses, you're kind of doing it all. You're probably working harder right now than you will maybe 10 years up the road.
Yeah, I hope that the work we put in now will allow me to, step back and watch it all happen. But for right now, yeah, just starting out, there's a lot of the jobs that other people usually do. I'm doing them all.
You told me when I called you and asked you to join me on the program that you've had some growing pains in terms of some of the help that you thought you were going to have on board with you that you haven't had on board now. And that's put you in a position where you're having to do not just your job, but their job too.
Sure. I think, right now, just the overall situation there's been around, there's just not a lot of, people floating around like there has been in the past looking for work. So, it's being a smaller outfit and, not having maybe the reputation or, the clout of the other bigger guys. I got to work a little harder to get people and, hopefully they'll start coming here since.
I mentioned the experience that you've gained over the years, and we're going to go back through your entire background and how you got interested in horse racing, but the immediate future has, or the immediate past has seen you working with Chad Brown. You started with him in 2016. You decided to go out on your own this summer. Boy, I can't think of a better person to learn from than a guy like Chad Brown.
Yeah, my most recent job being there. Yeah, absolutely. He was, when I was back working for Todd, he was kind of just starting out. And, what he did over the last, 10 years has just been unbelievable. So, when I got back from Saudi, me and him kind of got in touch and I had the opportunity to come join his team. And like I say, it was just one of the best decisions I could have made. I learned so much there and was around just such nice horses. I mean, the quality in those barns over the last couple of years was, probably hopefully something I'll see again. But if I didn't, you wouldn't be, too concerned with it just because they were so nice.
Yeah, pretty special to be able to learn from people like that. You mentioned Saudi Arabia. I want to talk about your time that you spent in Saudi Arabia too. But let's just go back to the beginning. You grow up in Louisville. I think your family moved there when you were two. Is that right?
Well, yeah. So my mom's from Louisville. My dad's from Northern Kentucky. My dad's an equine veterinarian. So at the time of my birth, he was actually working on a farm in it was a standardbred farm in central Ohio called Castleton. You know, the big standardbred country up there, Washington County. Mm-hmm. So he was up there until, I want to say, probably 83 when he came back to Kentucky. He bought, there was a vet clinic out in Shelbyville called Equine Services. He bought that, bought into it with some partners anyway, and that brought us back here. And then eventually we kind of moved back into Louisville, was probably at 84, something like that.
Okay. And your mom's no stranger to being around horses either.
No, they actually, you know, she's been around horses since she was very young. She's been, you know, active with polo horses, show horses, all sorts of discipline. They've got a farm out in LaGrange right now. They've got, you know, four or five horses out there they just keep. So we've, you know, all come by it pretty honestly.
Did they encourage you to get involved with horses, or did they say, okay, let's try to get you to do something else here, kid?
Right. They didn't really, and either way, they would have been happy with whatever I kind of fell into. Early on, I didn't have much interest, you know. It was just kind of part of life and never really something I even considered being, you know, something that would be a career or even a hobby. You know, when I was a kid, I liked playing soccer, skateboarding, just hanging out. You know, I just wasn't really into the lifestyle at that point. It was a lot of work. I saw how hard my dad worked, you know, as a vet. He was, you know, 7 days a week up before the sun comes up, sometimes, you know, a lot of days home after it went down. So, you know, I saw what went into it, but it wasn't really till after high school, you know, I did a couple years of college and realized I just wasn't finding what I was looking for in those places. So I just ended up kind of by happenstance out at a farm and just kind of caught, you know, caught the bug, I guess it was. It just something about it felt right at that time. So, you know, it's kind of, there's a old book called Acres of Diamonds where, you know, or the Alchemist is another, where you go out in search of your fortune, your riches, but ultimately it ends up being right under your feet, you know, right under your nose.
Yeah, it was there from the day that you were born. There's no doubt about it, with your sire and your dam, if you will, both being involved in the horses, and it, you know, just something that was almost meant to be. What were you thinking might be your career path before you decided to go down this road?
I really didn't have anything nailed down. I just, you know, was at that point after high school and college, I went to school at College of Charleston briefly, just kind of because that was what you did. It wasn't because I had anything picked out or really had my interest anywhere. I think I was a little, you know, kind of late to really focus on things, you know, figure out what I wanted to do at that point. It was just about having a good time and, you know, being a kid.
Growing up in Louisville and going to school at St. X, right? St. Xavier is where you went to high school before you ended up going on to college. You were growing up kind of around that same time period, I guess, as a guy like Brad Cox, who is a Louisville native. Norm Cassie, I guess he's kind of in that same realm too. Were you friendly with any of those guys growing up?
No, not growing up. I didn't know any of them.
You do now?
I do now, yeah. I know those guys now.
Were there any other horse people that you hung out with in high school or anything?
Not really, no. I think, you know, a lot of the people I hung out with I'd known since I was a kid out in Anchorage. I mean, there's some people who's, you know, family and had known people in the business, but I didn't have any, like, racetrack, I guess you could call it, acquaintances until I started on the racetrack.
I can imagine, Whit, that growing up in Louisville, even if you're not into horses and you're not even thinking about a career in horse racing, when that first Saturday in May comes around, it has to be one of those things that just makes you stop and pay attention, right?
Totally. I think that was kind of one of my first inklings that you could actually have a career with the horse, watching the Derby and seeing Wayne Lucas and just like, you know, there was, it was the celebrity and all of this that was like, you know, shown there on TV, just like this larger than life personalities, you know, that are training these horses. And I really didn't know what went into it at the point. I never really considered it early on, but it wasn't until later you see like, well, for the 5 seconds you see him in that big, you know, the spotlight, you know, accepting the trophy, saddling the horse, the work that goes into it, everything that's involved in that one, you know, moment on television is just something I never even really fathomed, you know?
Yeah, it's so true. We've had people mention that work with us here on the network, and when we get ready to broadcast the Kentucky Derby on radio, for example, that the countless hours that go into the prep for a two-hour show, something on that level, it's mind-boggling, really, when you think about it. But that's what makes people like a Dwayne Lucas, who you just mentioned, and Chad Brown, who you just worked with him, and Todd Pletcher, that's what makes those guys so successful, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's like, you know, for the couple minutes on the spotlight, that's the, you know, the necessity of it. But for the most part, it's the work you put in, day out, you know, showing up at 4:30, leaving late. You know, I've been privileged to work with, you know, some of the, you know, most outstanding trainers of the last two decades. You know, I've been very fortunate to see that and to see what goes into, you know, growing and maintaining a stable with such quality horses, and the people too, because people forget, you know, the horses are one thing, but you also have these staffs that you have to maintain, and you got to have good people, you know, especially with assistants and foremen and even down to the grooms and hot walkers. I mean, to have loyal people that are willing to show up and do the same job you would do if you were in the stall, it's hard to find. And, you know, to see that with, you know, Todd and Chad, that's, I think, one of the strengths of those guys is keeping such quality people, you know, year in, year out. This is a hard job. This is a lot of work. I can tell you firsthand, I've been grooming the last couple of days, and I forget over the years of kind of taking the assistant roles, the foreman roles, you kind of move further away from the labor-intensive type work. But kind of revisiting it now, it's just a new appreciation for just how, you know, I don't say backbreaking, but it's, you know, it's labor intensive. So to have people that are willing to show up and do that at the, you know, day in, day out, and follow your lead and follow your example, I think that's, you know, something we're all striving towards, you know, to be like, you know, the Todds and the Chad, and just have that work ethic that's going to, you know, trickle down all the way to the lowest guy on the totem pole. Because around here, I mean, when you have that many horses, you've got to have good people.
Yeah, and it's not just the work ethic. It's the management skills that a guy like a Todd Pletcher or a Chad Brown possesses, right?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, when you're dealing with large amounts of information, you figure with every one horse, you have a whole litany of, like, things you need to remember about that one horse. You know, you've got pedigree, you've got history, medical, riders, race. I mean, there's just so much to keep in a row, so when you do have to, you know, kind of, you know, make adjustments or move, you can call on that information regularly. And having things structured in a way to make it where, you know, it's not necessarily lost in the, you know, the translation, you can find it quickly.
How long do you think it takes a trainer when they first go out on their own to really hone their system and their approach? Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about on the business side of it, not so much on the, you know, the training side. How long does it take a trainer to learn those skills and come up with a plan?
I hope quickly. I'm right in that, you know, stage right now. You know, I've spent so much of the last, you know, 20 years really focusing on the inner workings of a racing stable, all the way from, you know, I've done every job, hot walking to grooming to riding to foreman to assistant and all of that, barn management, how to make a stable move efficiently and over multiple locations. You know, I've gotten to see that firsthand from these guys. Now, as far as running the business, these are things that it's going to be kind of a learn as I go. I don't know how long it's going to take, but I think, you know, as you start to, like I say, treat everything like a big deal and you just try to really focus on what's working for you, what's not working for you, and I'll be asking, you know, opening up and asking other guys. I think that's been one of the things for me so far, because I really, you know, it's, you'll ask, why do you do that on a foot? But you don't ask, well, what do you do with your taxes? You know, that's not something anybody really considers when, you know, you're making your way up through the ranks.
Yeah, because trainers are self-employed. I mean, they are running their own business. And I don't know if the average fan looks at it in that fashion, but that's exactly what it is.
Right, right.
Yeah, talking with trainer Whit Beckman here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. If you're just tuning into the show and just joining us, Whit has begun training horses on his own after working with folks like Todd Pletcher and with Chad Brown, who he's been with most recently since about 2016. You know, Graham Motion told me that he went to the University of Jonathan Shepherd, and that was a pretty good university to go to. You've attended some good ones, too, with the people you've worked with on the racetrack.
Yeah, I agree. I kind of, when I was working for Todd all those years, I never, you know, didn't do the real college experience, but that's what I considered my college experience because it was just as much of an education as I would get anywhere else. I mean, I was there for six something years, and I mean, the amount I learned about, you know, just the racetrack, racehorses, and how to put it all together was like, you know, any four-year bachelor's degree would be, you know, wouldn't be much easier.
What is it that sets a trainer like Todd Pletcher or Chad Brown apart from, I'll just call it, your average trainer? Because I look at those guys as being, I mean, they're elite, right? Todd's a Hall of Famer. Chad's a future Hall of Famer. They are elite. They're the best of the best. What sets them apart from just an average everyday trainer?
Well, I don't know really what average ever. I guess I think everybody has, you know, where they're willing to go and how big they want to grow. You know, I mean, obviously these guys have taken on numerous clients and they've had just such good horses over the years, but as trainers, as horsemen, I mean, that's number one. You got to be totally in tune with your horses. You got to really be able to kind of cut through, know where they want to run. You need to do it quickly. I think, you know, a lot of guys that are, in my opinion, top guys are the ones that get a horse in and they're able to spot them and identify what they want to do, how they want to do it quickly. You know, you're not wasting time running them in spots and trying to figure out what's going on with the horse when, you know, you're kind of, obviously these horses are all on, you know, they're like time bombs. Eventually you're not going to be able to run them anymore. So to get to their best as quickly as possible, I think is, you know, one of the marks of a great trainer, to be able to see a horse and know exactly what it wants to do.
What things do Todd and Chad have in common that make them successful? And maybe what are a couple of things that they do differently, but it works for each one?
I mean, fundamentally, it feels like everything, you know, I've worked for Owen Hardy, and well, I've worked for a lot of guys, and just fundamentally, I think everybody's doing the same thing, more or less. You know, you're taking your horses out, you're trying to get them fit while at the same time keeping them sound, and in the barn, you're trying to keep them happy, and there's just, you know, an attention to detail, I think, is obviously one of the major similarities between the two of them. Like, nothing goes unnoticed in those stables. Like, there is not a hair that's out of place on any of these horses that isn't noticed and, you know, addressed immediately. You know, you don't let things go, you know, do everything immediately. You know, that's always been something I learned from both of those guys. You know, obviously, it's about the horse. That's number one. You know, you always got to do what's right for the horse. And I think similarly, they're extremely, you know, they work well with people. I mean, they've got incredible people skills. I mean, they manage a lot of people, a lot of owners, a lot of expectations, and they're professionals at it.
So after spending those couple of years in college that you mentioned, that's when you decided, okay, maybe I want to explore the horse racing business and get into that. How did that come about and how did you end up making that decision?
So I just kind of happened to be out, going out to help my mom do some things at a farm where she had some horses, and there was, you know, some race horses laid up out there and some polo horses. And I just kind of, you know, at the time, I didn't really have any, you know, direction that I was, you know, pointed with anything. So whatever it was about being around the horse, just the animal, there wasn't anything else involved at that time. It was just, it kind of brought me back to where I felt connected to something, you know, where I felt like I was actually out there doing something that meant something. And I guess that is where the initial seed was probably born. And then as I kind of, you know, worked closely or more closer with the horses and more time, racing just kind of hooked me, you know. I just really, I enjoyed watching it. I enjoyed the feel. I always went back to that moment watching, I think it was like, I can't remember what horse it was, that one Thunder Gulch, maybe. I think that was the year when I saw Wayne there. I remember it when I was a kid, just up on the thing, accepting the trophy. And I just kind of kind of came together in that moment, I guess. You know, there was always like, I can actually do this as a job, you know. And it was ultimately the horse that brought me back, because I just, what I, you know,
what I feel when I'm around them is just like, you know, it's the right thing.
What was your first job on the racetrack?
I worked for Walter Bender, who was a trainer here, local trainer here in Louisville, hot walking. That was my first job.
Wow. Walter Bender is a guy who had a lot of success. Wasn't the likes of Todd Pletcher or Chad Brown, but somebody who had to be great to learn from.
Oh, for sure. He was, you know, ex-jock and just a, you know, real, just a great horseman. He just, you know, had a real good feel for things, and just kind of starting there, it was a great introduction to, you know, we didn't have a big stable, we had like 20 horses or something like that. So just, you know, to be able to learn and really just get comfortable with the race horses, it was, you know, a great spot.
Yeah. How long did it take you to get comfortable, you know, being around them and, you know, putting your hands on them and doing everything that you needed to do to kind of learn and get started?
Well, fortunately for me, like, even though I never had a lot of interest, I've been around them. I've been in stalls. I've been helping my dad since I was a kid. So I've never had any apprehension with a horse. I've never been afraid of a horse. A horse has always been right there. I mean, they put food on my table my entire life. So as far as I've always been very comfortable, I guess. That was never a thing. But just kind of learning, because there's, you know, obviously differences between your typical pleasure horse to, you know, a fit racehorse in training, you know, and just understanding the nuances about what makes them tick and, you know, how to approach them as opposed to, you know, a pony that's been on in a show barn or something like that.
Where did you go after working with Walter?
I actually went out to, there's a breeding farm where my dad has been the vet out in Oldham County. He was actually Alex Rankin, the chairman of the board here at Churchill owns. It's called Ups and Downs. So I went out there and ran, worked in the layup barn, kind of learned a lot about, you know, injury, post-surgical, and really got to, for me, like horsemanship, good horsemanship, it's tough to learn sometimes on the racetrack because we're so hurried, we're so rushed, there's a lot of corners cut, there's a lot of things that you probably look at and say, oh, that's probably not the best way to do it, but you know what, it works, so let's just do it. On the farm with the yearlings, the babies, the foal and mares, everything, you really get just a more well-rounded feel for how to deal with, you know, horses. Like walking a yearling around is going to teach you a lot about horses. They're totally erratic. You know, they're young horses. They're far more react. You know, they just haven't had as much time with people hands-on and been handled as much. So, you know, you learn a lot from just, you know, kind of being in that position.
As you were telling that story, Whit, I was thinking back to when I first got started in horse racing. My wife and I moved from Massachusetts down to Kentucky and really knew nobody. We started knocking on doors, trying to get a foot in the door somewhere. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in the industry. I was never around horses like you, so I was never good with working with horses. My first job came at the Jockey Club with a gentleman by the name of Steve Gillespie, who was nice enough to hire me, and he was doing all of the sales catalogs that you get when you go to a horse sale. And I was able to learn so much about the pedigree side of the sport, and it just, you know, I didn't even know the proper language. I used to say that a horse is, you know, out of Seattle Slough, right?
Yeah.
I never knew it was by Seattle Slough, out of the dam, but I learned all of that when I got involved, and I'm sure it was very much that same experience for you, working with the young horses, seeing how it worked on the farm.
Totally. I think, you know, you just kind of assume that the horses, you know, the finished product is what we have, and that's the horse. But, you know, how much goes into getting a horse to the racetrack and, you know, all the jobs you can do along the way. And I'm fortunate to have, you know, been able to witness it and, you know, learn firsthand from some really good horsemen who, you know, have been out on these farms and have been, you know, looking at horses since they were kids and just, you know, got a lot of, you know, real solid knowledge.
Maybe I'm fast-forwarding too much with this next question, and please feel free to tell me if I am, but how do you go from working with Walter Bender, learning from the ground up, then learning at your dad's farm, learning from the ground up, to all of a sudden being in Saudi Arabia?
Just kind of one thing led to the next, I guess. I was working on the breeding farm, and then a friend of the family got me hooked up with kind of Darley and Dave Scanlon. We were getting two-year-olds ready. Keeneland, this is probably 2005 or 6 or something. So I got hooked up with Dave Scanlon. I was working with him more closely with his assistant, Danny Moncada, who's, you know, been around for a long time. And through that, I met Owen Hardy. Owen got me when we kind of dispersed all the two-year-olds, he got me hooked up with Todd. And then that was 2007. I started with him. And then the Saudi Arabia offer came in 2013. I want to say right after Derby 2013. I think it was Revolutionary, Charming Kitten, Verrazano. There's two more, but I can't remember. Right after that Derby is when that was my last day, kind of last day with Todd the next day, and that's when I went to Saudi.
Wow, you must have jumped at that opportunity.
Yeah, I think, you know, after, you know, 6 years with Todd, and it was, I felt comfortable enough. I mean, there was a little apprehension, but at the same time, it was kind of like, you know, I felt like, not that I accomplished everything, but I just felt like it was time to do something different. I never, you know, a person that wants to get caught in the same old thing forever. You know, I like the variety. I like the change. I like to grow. I like to evolve. So for me, it just seemed like a good next step. You know, you gotta go, you got one owner, you don't juggle a lot of owners, it's a private job, which, you know, obviously if they don't like you, then it turns into a bad thing, because then they, you know, you lose all the horses. But it actually ended up working out real well. I you know, went over there, and I only did, you know, just one season that first year, but the experience and just the challenges and just what I faced over there really gave me just a new dimension on how to adjust, adapt, and just make the best of the situation that, you know, some with horses, we all know that pretty much, you know, what can go wrong does go wrong. And, you know, I dealt with that on a lot of, you know, different aspects, but it, I mean, I guess say character building or whatever, it was a tremendous experience for me.
By the way, overanalyze and Palace Malice are not happy you left
go.
Them out of that Derby
field.
I know.
Palace Malice especially. I shouldn't have forgotten him. Oh, yeah.
Well, hey, I mean, Todd's run so many horses in the Derby, and when he's saddling five.
I know. That's over those years. I'm surprised I remember the three of them.
well, listen.
A long time ago.
We have about another minute or so left. I want to talk to you more about your time in Saudi Arabia when we come back. So why don't we do this? Let's go ahead and get to a short commercial break. I will come back and continue this visit with trainer Whit Beckman, who is my special guest, just getting started with this training career and what a career it promises to be. Should be a lot of fun to hear the rest of his story in the second half of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Nominations are still open for the Fasig Tipton November Sale, the world's premier breeding stock event. Last year, the sale produced the 8 highest-priced fillies and mares sold at any U.S. breeding stock sale, led by Monomoy Girl, selling for $9.5 million. 22 horses sold for $1 million or higher, and the sale also produced the co-highest-priced weanling sold in the U.S. last year. Nominate your best today to the Fasig Tipton November Sale, a night of stars, Tuesday, November 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you sell? The richest meet in Oak Lawn's history begins Friday, December 3rd through Sunday, May 8th. The 66-day meet will offer more than $45 million in purses with 36 stakes races totaling $12.3 million. And all allowance races are now worth $100,000. Oak Lawn boasts the richest Triple Crown prep series in the country, highlighted by the $1 million Rebel on Friday, February 26th, and the Grade 1 Arkansas Derby Saturday, April 2nd, now offering a purse of $1.25 million. Learn more at oaklawn.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
So it is a Raving Beauty turning for home in front. Magic Wand on the outside second. Final Delusion comes into the stretch three wide. Then Four Star Crook, Sister Charlie on the far outside. Into the final furlong, the Raving Beauty trying to hold off Wild Illusion, and here she comes. Sister Charlie is there too, and then it's Magic Wand, a 16th to go. Here comes Wild Illusion after a Raving Beauty. Sister Charlie on the far outside. The three of them coming down to the line, and it is Sister Charlie who ran down Wild Illusion in the last strides to do it. A Raving Beauty held on for third, and Magic Wand was fourth.
Well, what a moment for Sister Charlie, who scored in the Philly and Mare turf. Larry Colmus had the call. Special, special filly, and she is one of several outstanding horses that my special guest, Whit Beckman, had the chance to be around when he was working with four-time champion trainer Chad Brown. We're going to talk more about that here in the second half of the program. Welcome back to Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you on this Wednesday evening as always. And if you missed any portion of our conversation in the first half of the show or any of our Trainer Talk programs, it's easy. Head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows from, gosh, all the way back to 2012 with our very first one with Ron Ellis. They're there for you to listen to on our website at horseracingradio.net. Well, with that call of Sister Charlie, had to bring back some good memories, huh?
Yeah, it was. So they're kind of bittersweet. I was actually at Aqueduct that day. It was the one day they decided, I guess, they were going to run all the way through that horse in the first race and the last race. I watched the entire Breeders' Cup card in the theater at Aqueduct.
Wow.
But, yeah, that was an amazing. I remember Raving Beauty just, you know, right there. I'm thinking at the, you know, eighth, I was like, still, we might just do it. You know, we kind of had her as, you know, a miler at mile and a 16th be her best distance, but she really ran a good race. But then, you know, Sister Charlie just coming out of the clouds like she would do in so many occasions. She was just such a nice filly. Like, you know, I can't say enough about her. Like, you know, and that's not even probably the best one that we got to, you know, I got to be around, you know, there at Belmont when I worked for Chad down there from 2017 through 2020. I mean, the horses I saw were just, I mean, one better than the next.
Yeah, Sister Charlie, of course, was a champion. She went on to win the Eclipse Award that year as the champion turf female. You know, and she was one that, like you said, she was just so, so good. And she showed up pretty much every single time you brought her over there. And that's a really special quality, isn't it?
Absolutely. When you have a horse that knows when it's like time and they know when they're going over there, that's, you know, that's one of those, the indefinable quality that everybody's trying to buy. And, you know, you just hope when you have it.
Who were some of the other horses that you worked with Chad, that always are going to stand out to you and you're always going to remember?
Wow. Well, Rushing Fall would probably be up there. She was my second year with him. She was a two-year-old. So I was fortunate enough to get to saddle her a few times, a few grade ones at Keeneland. And, you know, I had her quite a bit of the time down at Belmont when I was his assistant down there. So she would be one of those for me. Let's think, Bricks and Mortar was another one. He was more or less around through most of my time there, you know, is from three-year-old up to, I think he ran at five-year-old. He was another one. Cloud Computing was one. So I guess whatever year it was that he won the Preakness, he had come up to me in New York in early or kind of early-ish middle November. So I got to spend a lot of time with that horse and really kind of got it, developed him up in New York. Chad thought it'd be a better surface for him, which it ended up being. And he won, you know, broke his maiden. And he ran, I think he was second in the Gotham maybe, and then third in the Wood, and then, you know, went on and won the Preakness. So that was one of the highlights, just being able to spend so much time with that horse who we identified as a very talented individual, you know, early on.
How about Good Magic?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Good Magic. He was, you know, as far as two-year-olds that year, he wasn't a real big horse, but he had that, like we're talking about, that quality. I mean, he knew what he was doing. He wanted to win. I mean, there wasn't probably a better horse in the country to, I mean, to run with Justify the way he did. And, like, I mean, he was an outstanding specimen and just an easy going horse, you know, very, you know, not mean, not vicious, just, you know, very easy to be around.
I'm going to tell you maybe my favorite Chad Brown runner of all time for me personally, and that was Uni. I absolutely loved Uni.
Oh, yeah.
I thought she was, you know, tough as nails.
She was. I think I've used that same quote on talking about her before at when we won the first lady at Keeneland. She was a small filly, not a big package. She was one of those just kind of stood still, never really did anything wrong, just trained every day. You know, she was an amazing filly. I'll tell you another one that was one of my favorite was a filly called Four Star Crook, who actually got the call in that race. Mm-hmm. She was a New York bred, but that's another one, was tough as I've ever been around, tough race mare as I've ever been around. She just, every time you brought her over, she showed up. The only time she got beat she got beat by the best in the country. You know, she was no slouch, that filly.
How about during your time working with Todd Pletcher? Are there a couple of horses that stand out to you there?
Sure, sure. Number one, Uncle Mo. That was probably one of my – so he came in. I remember being in Saratoga. I pulled him off the van, you know, and just got the – you know, early on, we knew. Like, his first 3/8, everybody just like, oh, wow, okay. We might have a good horse here, you know. So it was pretty special to watch him kind of develop and stay thirsty right there with him. I mean, the two of them came, same van, same farm, and you had, you know, a Travers winner and then Uncle Mo, you know, the Kelso and other, you know, flashy – wins. Escandarea was another one of my favorites. He was, in my opinion, probably one of the best dirt horses I ever saw. He just, you know, the legs didn't hold up, you know, all the way through the Triple Crown trail, but had he been healthy and run, I feel like, you know, he would have been a special horse. And I mean, there's so many more with Malice, that was another one, had him early on in Saratoga. You know, he won from mile and a half to 6 furlongs. He was just another, just an athlete, you know, just very talented.
Yeah, you know, there's that saying that it's called the look of eagles, right, where a horse will have that, whatever it is, that it factor, that presence about them, the great ones, mm-hmm. and they all seem to kind of have it. They all seem to kind of know that they're good. What is it that separates a great horse from your ordinary stakes horse on a Saturday afternoon?
I guess the simple answer would be they're faster than the other horses. But
yeah,
you got to figure with that speed, there's got to be some level of wanting it more, because, I mean, once you get up to those top levels, I mean, you know, trip and just guts, they, you know, that's usually the difference. I mean, horses to be in those races, we know they're good. We know they're fast. So you're hoping you get a good ride and you have a horse that wants to win. You know, sometimes the race isn't going to work out the way you want. You have a horse that can overcome the little, you know, piece of adversity. Then that's kind of what you're looking for.
Is it similar to human athletes where, you know, we hear it all the time in sports that, you know, this person just refuses to lose. They just hate to lose. They're right. going to do whatever they can possibly do to win in any particular competition. Are horses like that too, where you have horses that you just know, hey, if this horse is in a battle, they're not getting beat?
Yeah, I think some of them, for sure. Some of them, absolutely. You know, when they're lined up and they're turning for home and you know they're going to face somebody, like, it's always nerve-wracking and it's always, you know, the adrenaline that gets you, but still you're pretty confident that they know what they're doing and they're going to get there.
Talking with trainer Whit Beckman here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Whit, let's talk more about your time in Saudi Arabia. We kind of were wrapping up with that or winding down the first half of the program when we got to that particular subject. How'd you like Saudi Arabia? How'd you like training over there?
It had its moments, its highs, but I mean, it was, I'm glad I did it, but it was very challenging. I think there were some things I didn't really think about going over there. Language barrier was the biggest thing. It was real tough because, you know, when you get into these spots, you think, you know, working for Todd, you can kind of organize everything in a way where, you know, people should be able to just feed off of that. But when they don't read English, write English, or, you know, more or less have any sort of, idea what I'm talking about or writing out, that was the toughest part. Early on was just kind of getting a point where I could communicate with my people. I didn't have anybody that spoke real good English. I had a couple of fellows that were from India that were able to kind of help me bridge the gap. But, you know, once we got through all that, things started to kind of get a little bit easier.
Yeah. How did you end up making that work? Did you just rely on, you mentioned the folks from India. Did you rely on translators? Is that how you had to do it?
Yeah, not really. Cause I didn't have a translator. Like the guy, one of the guys who was kind of in charge of, you know, kind of helping me get through stuff. He was, you know, helpful in certain spots, but from like a day to day situation, he wasn't with me in the barn. So I had a couple of kids that spoke a little bit of English and they helped me kind of just get to the point where I just simplified everything all the way. You know, that was what was one of the lessons I need to learn, was just to kind of simplify, and you can't complicate things. Essentially, you're just going to get this horse, take it to the track, train it, and bring it back. So what I kind of did was just kind of forget everything about all the lists and all the, you know, trying to keep everything information organized for them and just kind of use that for me. But with everybody, it became just so hands-on. I mean, I was just in there telling everybody, kind of pointing and, you know, more or less grabbing the horses and doing what I needed to get done myself, you know, and using the guys that could help me, you know, with communicating to my grooms, communicating to my riders, and just, you know, putting it together like that. It was not, definitely not the prettiest, but we got it done.
Yeah, you were a head trainer there, so it gave you a taste of what being the head signal caller is all about. Do you think that experience helps you now that you transition out on your own?
Sure, 100%. I would say, like, there's, even though right now things could be looked at, you know, we're going through some growing pains. It's tough to find people. You know, I'm doing a lot of work. It's still my worst, or, you know, worst day here is better than my best day over there in some cases, because it was, there were so many challenges I had. If I just started listing stuff off, I'd be like, whoa, wow. You know, between not having veterinarians or farriers, you know, there's just so many things that we take for granted here that I was unable to find, you know, somebody to get a good rapport with. You know, it was, there was, I had no vet. You know, the farrier was somebody, a kid, you know, probably 5 years younger than me, had been shoeing for a year, you know. So there was just so many challenges. And, you know, that's just in the stable. Obviously, there was external circumstances, which also made things more difficult. But, yeah, it was what it did. And I look at it, it taught me how to deal with adversity, to adjust, to learn how to just, sometimes you got to throw the playbook out and you just got to go with what feels right. You know, you can't, you know, hold yourself, because we learn a way to do things. We learn what Todd does. We learn what Chad does. And we want to try to reproduce that because it's so effective. It you know, generates results. But every situation is not going to be able to be treated like that. So to be able to recognize where, you know, you can definitely assert, you know, a program like there, or you just have to kind of throw that out and just go with what feels right in the moment.
You know, wherever I go, when we were traveling, doing all of our race coverage over the years now, I always try to make sure I know where the good restaurants are. And I'm always curious when people go to a foreign country like that, what the food is like.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that Saudi Arabia wasn't known for their hot browns, right?
No, not their hot browns. But I love the food over there. I've always been like, I mean, like Indian food or just Middle Eastern. There was a place that we used to go, kind of us. There was a couple other, you know, guys, Western guys, South Africa, France, an Italian guy. We used to go out for breakfast every morning at a place called Mohammed's. And they had this bread, and they make this stuff called shashuka. It was like a scrambled egg thing and full, which is this bean dip. And at night they would make this barbecue chicken. It was like, it was unbelievable. It was like, I still think about how good that chicken was. It was the best barbecue chicken I've ever had. I think it was some guys from Afghanistan or Pakistan that made it. I can't remember, but it was outstanding.
Wow. Did you pick up on any of the recipes, and will you make it at home now? Maybe not the barbecue chicken.
No, I didn't have the presence of mind back then to think about how they do it, but the spices and just the way it's all put together. It was so the first time I was there, I just, you know, I ate it a lot. And then when I left, I was like, man, I'll never get to have that again. And I ended up going back. So, you know, the food alone was worth maybe the second trip back.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. So now that you're back in Louisville and you're out training on your own, I'm curious, what led you to make that move? You're with a guy like Chad Brown. You're in a great position, and you decide, you know what? I'm going to throw caution to the wind, and I'm going to start my own business, and I'm going to do it with six horses and do everything myself. What makes you make that call?
Well, with Chad, we had, you know, the string here, and when they're redoing the turf course here at Churchill, so not having any turf here in the fall, Chad wasn't real keen on leaving a string down here. So I've got, you know, family down here, my daughter, and just enough incentive for me to kind of stop the traveling, just to spend more time and be, you know, a fixture in her life, and, you know, be more involved with, you know, the family, my nieces and nephews, and just, you know, growing up and really trying to, obviously, you know, work is important, but family is more important. So I think staying local is mostly just to be with them. And obviously I'm in a lucky position that in Louisville, there is a, you know, historic racetrack where I can do the job I've, you know, been training to do for the last 20 years. And,
you know, be able to go home at night and see my, you know, my daughter. And it's just, yeah, to me, that's worth everything. I would take a pay cut every day of the week to be, you know.
Yeah, how old is she?
5.
Would you want her to be a horse trainer when she grows up?
She can be whatever she wants. I wouldn't suggest it, but she knows. She comes to work with me. She sees what goes into it. Me and her, you know, mom as well, we're both involved. So, you know, she knows just how much work and how involved. And, you know, she gets up when I come, you know, I have her on the weekends. When she comes to work with me, she sleeps in the car, and then she comes to the office. She knows it's busy. It's a lot of work. So I don't think she's going to pick it, but you never know.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Byron King had that nice piece on you that he wrote that appears on Blood Horse, and people can go read it at bloodhorse.com. But you had a quote in there that I loved. You said that you were glad that you stuck in there and didn't make any moves before you thought that you might be ready. And, of course, I'm paraphrasing. Right. But then you went on to say that now it's just all green lights and I feel over-prepared. You do?
Right. Yeah, I think to the extent when it comes, obviously, with that is actually applies to the running of a stable, of a racing stable, you know, in the morning, what we do. Obviously, we talked about the business part earlier. Do I feel overprepared for that? No. But when it comes to what can be seen and what we'll have to handle and what we're up against training horses, oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen so much over the last 20 years, and I've worked with such good people that whatever the situation was, you just kind of buy – you know, by proxy, you're around it. You just know how to instinctively handle these things. I mean, you see these guys and how they, you know, their thought processes and how they approach each situation. And, you know, the time with Todd, I mean, that prepared me to an extent. And then with Chad, that prepared me to another extent. You know, I just got to, like, take on so much knowledge and so much experience with just such good horsemen that not a lot of people get to, you know, see firsthand what goes on in the two most dominant barns of, you know, since 2005, you know. And I guess had I done things earlier or not, you know, taken the time to really get in and focus, I mean, maybe I'd get out and I'd be fine, but maybe there'd be more growing pains and maybe I wouldn't have made it, or maybe I won't make it now. But at the same time, I feel like if it is now, it's not because I don't know what I'm doing. It's got to be because of some, you know, extenuating circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that it's very interesting. What's the one thing that's really driving you and motivating you right now, Whit?
Driving and motivating, winning races.
Yeah.
I want to win races. I think it's a lot of, obviously, this is, you know, the career I've chosen, so that enough is just motivation to get up and do it work. You know, the work itself is worth it, every bit of it for me. It's not even necessarily about the results, because if you're going to hang on results, we, you know, good trainers lose 80% of the races they win. So that's not necessarily, you know, the sole motivating factor. It's the work I enjoy. It's being around these animals. It's, you know, what they have the possibility to, you know, kind of inspire and give us just by nature of who they are. I mean, you look at the relationship with horses and humans over the last, for, you know, however many years. I mean, it's just incredible what we can do with them and what they do for us. So for me to be able to come in and provide whatever I can, the best situation possible for them to be their best, because they're being bred for this. They're, like, specifically being bred to send out to us. So in that, we owe them every bit of our time, effort, consideration, compassion to put them in the spot where they can be their best. And sometimes that's not a racehorse, you know. And sometimes it's a grade one horse. So,
yeah, I think. Yeah, I was told from a very young age that if you put your nose to the grindstone, if you will, and you work your tail off and you do things the right way, that success will follow. And I mm-hmm. think that's it sounds to me like that's the same philosophy that you're subscribing to.
I think so. I think with anything, yeah. You know, even if you take some failures and you get beat up, it's the guys that keep getting back up and getting on that horse, so to speak, are the ones that end up crossing the finish line. You know, if you get knocked down a few times and you want to stay there, well, that's fine. That's where you're going to stay. But, you know, it's a challenge from day one. But I think life for me, I mean, like, being a human is challenges. You're either going to pick your challenges, they're going to be picked for you. So, you know, you might as well do what you want.
Yeah. Talking with trainer Whit Beckman on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. I mentioned at the top of the show, and if people are just tuning in for some reason now and they missed the past 40, 45 minutes of our conversation, they're probably thinking, okay, well, who's this guy and why aren't they talking about the races that he's won? Well, it's because of the fact that you haven't actually saddled your first horse here in the United States in your own name. You haven't done that yet. When might we see the first Whit Beckman horse go to the post?
I've got what I've got in the barn. I'm kind of preparing for Keeneland. I've got, you know, a couple that I think should be ready middle to end of the meet. And then a couple that I'm probably going to be looking at Churchill. And obviously that's, you know, the schedule I've kind of put down, and hopefully we can stick to that.
Yeah, you know, I was actually looking for, we played the call of Sister Charlie coming out of the commercial break at the bottom of the hour. Mm-hmm. And I was actually looking for a clip of Yes, It's True, because you have a couple of horses that are out of Yes, It's True mares. So I'm thinking you're probably a big fan of Yes, It's True.
I mean, I really don't know enough about it. Just happened to get a couple. I didn't realize. Yeah, I got two of them. But
yeah.
I know we had a good horse by Yes, It's True with Todd, a horse called Aconite. That was probably the closest. Yeah, that was a few years back.
Yep. One of those horses is a daughter of Malibu Moon. The other one, a son of Into Mischief. Not bad sires either.
No. When the guys that were there to support me early on, I, you know, could be in way worse position. These are, you know, very well bred horses.
Yeah. One of the two I'm talking about, of course, Think Twice and Truly Mischief. And Think Twice has a personal connection for you, at least in terms of the owner and the breeder. Tell me about that.
So Chip Montgomery, my family grew up next to him and his family. His son Chapman and me are same age. We went to grade school and high school together. We're still very, very, very good friends to this day. Our families used to vacation together and cookouts, and just we all went to the same school. We just, you know, very close. You know, I mean, we were literally right next door, like, you know, I don't know, probably 100 yards, you know, from door to door. So when when I kind of got started, you know, with Todd and stuff, he always said that if I went out on my own, he would, you know, support me, as he kind of later on got into the breeding aspect of things. And he's got a nice farm in Simpsonville called Haymarket. Yes. So he's kind of grown and, you know, I put myself in this position. He was the first one to say, yeah, I'll send you a horse.
Yeah, fantastic. You need people like that in your corner. And it's great to,
for sure,
to have that personal relationship too, because I think it helps, at least in terms of, you know, the owner understanding what you are going through as a young trainer. I think that you need somebody that's going to be a little bit patient too, right?
For sure. He's a great guy to support a lot of, you know, smaller outfits and smaller guys. And, with the size operation he's got, he could have done it the other way and just gone top of the line, everything. But he's done a lot to just help guys starting out, you know, with his brood mares and, you know, other aspects. He's just a very supportive. He's just a good person, you know.
How many horses do you have now?
I've got five.
Five horses. And how many are owned by Chip Montgomery?
Yeah, just one.
Just Think Twice.
Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned getting the horses ready to run potentially later in the meet at Keeneland. What's the game plan after that moving forward?
Well, we're going to stable. We're here at Churchill. We'll stable Churchill through November. Hopefully have one or two to run in that meet. And then this first year, I feel like the right thing to do, just for the business and the growth, and just, you know, obviously money is, when it's not coming in yet, you got to kind of think about, you know, where you want to spend it. So I'm going to stay local and do Turfway this winter. My uncle, Tom, my dad's brother, is the veterinarian up there. I don't think they have but one veterinarian at Turfway Park anymore.
Yeah.
So he has a place close to it. So I'll be able to kind of, you know, find lodging, and it'll be a really easy situation to kind of move into for the first year. And then as time goes on, you know, I did enough years in New York in the winter, and the warm isn't necessarily that attractive to me, but I like some horses in Florida just don't do that well. So I know they like the cold.
Yeah. Yeah, probably much more than I do. See, I'm more of a warm weather guy. I'll go to Florida any winter you want me to go to Florida. I'll be happy to be down there for you, Whit.
Yeah. I'll hopefully make a visit or two, but for the most part, I don't mind a little brisk temperatures.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, we're down to the final 2.5 minutes or so. Do you see yourself eventually wanting to be as big as a Todd Pletcher or a Chad Brown in terms of the numbers that you would have?
No. Those guys, they're in a league of their own. I don't think that I'm looking for more than, they're 3-4 strings or whatever. I would say for me, just to kind of, stay local here in Kentucky, if I had, to split up, because it's tough to get enough stalls. I mean, if I could have, 2 strings down here and, kind of manage it that way, 40, 50 horses would be a perfect situation for me. I see the kind of work, and it's not that I, wouldn't do it, but I think just for what I'm looking to do, and I don't know that I want to be that big. I mean, and say it like it's just that easy to do, what I mean? It's the what goes into, recruiting that many horses and people and being able to provide outstanding care and, win races for it's not easy. And, if it organically turns into that, I'm not going to stop it. But at the same time, it's not my intention to have, 200, 300 horses.
Yeah. Well, it looks like about 1.5 minutes left, Whit. I always like to end the show by asking trainers to tell me something about them that people might not know that we haven't touched on yet. So any other hobbies or interests outside of racing?
Hobbies or interests outside of racing? I meditate daily. I think
really?
That helps kind of, it keeps everything level. This is such a business. There's so much stress. There's so much just. It's nonstop. Your phone's not ringing. Somebody's trying to find you, with the horses. They're constantly trying to hurt themselves, and you're more or less giving out bad news. So I think to maintain, a stillness, a silence about, me and a real centered, I think that's important to me. It's very important to me, actually. I think, kind of running around like a chicken with my head cut off without having a place to kind of ground to, that's not a way I want to, and it's come through time, over, the years. I've kind of found what works for me insofar as just keeping my, feet on the ground and being able to focus forward rather than getting caught up in the momentary knee-jerk reactions that sometimes life can give.
Yeah, well, can't miss Whit Beckman, future star in the sport of thoroughbred racing. My thanks to him for taking time here today. Whit, appreciate it. All the best with the new operation.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, don't forget, if you missed any portion of the show, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast at your leisure and follow us on social media, at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. Now for my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studios, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.